Agenda item 12, which is a meeting with Francine Madden and discussion. So I had the privilege last night of just saying hi for a moment or two with in my dog identification class with Dr. Martella, which led me to, where did you do your PhD?
Dalmatian versus English Setter.
It was dark. In the hall.
Is that what you said in your dissertation defense, too?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the Commission, Director Unsworth. Pleased to be here and introduce you to Francine Madden, the Executive Director of the Human Wildlife Conflict Collaboration. What we'd like to do today is give you an update on a stakeholder process for implementing the Wolf Conservation and Management Plan. And before I turn it over to Francine to kind of she'll describe to you that stakeholder process and kind of the human dimensions work that she is doing, I wanted to set the stage a little bit and talk about some of our progress and challenges with implementing the Wolf Conservation Management Plan to date. As you know, it was adopted in December 2011. We have four main goals in that plan: recover wolf populations, minimize conflict with livestock, maintain a healthy prey base, and the fourth goal that we're going to talk about today of seeking a public understanding for wolf management and coexistence. So on each of those goals, we come before you a couple times a year to give you an update on how we're doing on those four goals. And we're seeing progress on three of the four of those. One of the items that former Director Anderson talked about just before he left the department was what's troubling to us is the lack of progress on that fourth goal, seeking a public understanding for wolf management and coexistence. Understanding that and knowing that that's a big piece of wolf management and looking at other states with wolf management, we established the Wolf Advisory Group in 2012. At that point, it was a 9-member citizen panel that's objective is to advise the department on implementing the details and the policies associated with the Wolf Conservation Management Plan. So as we worked with that, we call it WAG, Wolf Advisory Group, in those first couple years, we actually did not see the progress that we were looking for. We would take items to WAG, looking for their input and advice on implementing different components of wolf management. And rather than seeing the cohesion or consensus that we'd hoped for, we actually saw the group starting to pull apart and create more conflict and not find any sort of center ground on some of the issues surrounding wolf management. So about a year into that, we decided to grab a facilitator, an in-house facilitator at the time, to see if that could help us along in that process, and still did not see any progress towards really meaningful input by our stakeholders on implementing the plan. And again, just continued to see an erosion, and just the opposite, where the WAG process was actually creating conflict amongst our stakeholders because their disagreement was, and the distance between their values was so far. So at that point, as I mentioned, it was just before Director Anderson left the agency. It was very clear to us that we're on the wrong path. If we looked around at some of the other states, the Great Lakes states and the Rocky Mountain DPS states, and saw that even many of those states, 15, 18 years into wolf management, still have this underlining level of root conflict that is not going away as wolf management enters into the 5th and 10th and 15th year. It's still there. It still manifests itself in terms of litigations and those kinds of things, and we see that today in some of the Rocky Mountain and Great Lakes states. So at that point, we decided to kind of reassess and come at it a little different direction and start to really look at this human dimension side, the social sciences side, and reach out for some expertise. And I'll turn it over to Francine in just a moment, but we first brought Francine on a little over a year ago to do a conflict assessment, I think she'll talk about. It was really an eye-opener for us and gave us a path that said, here is the level of conflict that Washington is experiencing and how broad and deep that conflict is, and here are some strategies to try to address that deep-rooted conflict and do it a little different than perhaps other jurisdictions, other states have, and not be that state that's 15 years into it and still have this level of conflict. So Francine's going to give us an update on what that path looks like so far and what is a part of that path, and then be happy to answer any questions. Francine?
Thank you, Donnie. It is a pleasure and honor to be here, so thank you, Chairman Smith, Commissioners, Dr. Unsworth. I'm going to talk today about what it means to build a path to peace. So first, I just want you to imagine a future state of Washington where you have diverse stakeholders who are empowered to creatively solve problems together, where the divide between East and West is only geographical, where government has credibility and is trusted, where rural communities are vibrant and resilient, and they coexist with healthy, sustainable populations of predators. As I give this presentation, I want you to think about whether what strategy gets you there. Is it war or is it peace building? I'm going to talk about what is conflict. What do we mean by conflict? We often think of conflict as something bad. But conflict is actually inherent in human communities. You don't have a relationship with a spouse, with a child, with a neighbor, with a community, with colleagues, unless there's conflict. We think about conflict as being negative because we often think of that destructive conflict. But conflict can actually be very constructive as well. It can be a constructive opportunity for change. That destructive conflict, when we're afraid of that, or we think we're going into that, we often respond in a fight or flight response. Individuals do that, groups, communities, institutions. Conflict also exists at multiple scales. So talking to stakeholders around this conflict, you have conflict at a local level, state, regional, national, and international. And all of those different scales interact, and there's reactivity between those scales in this very large, complex system, which is dynamic. There is a constant ebb and flow of conflict, and there's a lot of reactivity in this conflict system. What is conflict transformation? Conflict transformation essentially is peace building embedded in social justice. It's informed by multiple scientific disciplines from neurology, psychology, sociology, anthropology, complexity science, and systems theory. And it's, the essential idea is to take, when there's destructive conflict, is to take that energy and turn it into a constructive opportunity for change. So the idea is not to manage it, it's not to shove it down, it's not to ignore it, but to engage with it in a constructive way. Our focus in our approach is focusing on the relationships, the processes in that system, and the larger system. It's not focusing on the substance. That's the job of the stakeholders and all of those who are involved in it. The other important component of this is preventing collateral damage. So oftentimes when we make a decision, we take an action, we say, I'm going to do A because I'm intending for effect B to happen, and maybe B does happen. But what can often happen in that system is that there's collateral damage, and you can end up getting other costs that outweigh any of the benefits of that decision. So understanding that complex system and how to engage with it allows you to better prevent those unintended negative consequences. Conflict transformation is also a mid to long-term approach. The idea is to create and sustain positive change within that system. So it's not looking for a short-term fix. It's looking for positive change in that system. Why would you want to integrate conservation conflict transformation in the wolf issue, in any issue? And that is because the solution to war is not more war. It's peace. And often we respond to war with tools and strategies that further deepen that pattern of war. And when you have a destructive pattern of conflict, over time that pattern repeats itself and it deepens. So you have to intervene in that destructive pattern in order to start to try to transform it. The other thing is, and this is from a systems approach, is recognizing that often yesterday's solution, what we thought was a great solution yesterday, can become today's battle. And then whether and how today's battle is won or lost then fuels that conflict for another day. Again, repeating and deepening that pattern of conflict. The other thing is in conflict over fish, wildlife issues, 90% of that conflict, 90% of the challenge and the opportunity is with people. It's not really about that issue. That issue just brings you in. It's the engagement around the people, the institutions, the groups, and the communities. That's where your challenge is, but that's also really where your opportunity is. Emotions drive decision-making. Scientists often want to keep emotions out of decision-making because it seems like that's something. Let's stick to the facts, people. Keep emotions out. But neurology tells us that emotions drive decision-making. You can't keep emotions out of it. Not only that, but if your emotions are constructive and positive, not positive like, oh, we're having a kumbaya session here, but positive in the fact that you feel that you can work together, groups demonstrate better judgment, higher quality results. And so emotions actually add value to decision making. And again, conflict transformation operates on multiple scales. So in the wolf conflict, there is the local scale where you can look at where are the wolves now, where is the livestock depredation occurring, that kind of thing. But then you can look at it as a statewide, right? These are state endangered species. You know, you have the state boundaries. So maybe this is a statewide conflict. Yes, it's that too. But it's also a regional conflict, right? It's in the American West, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's also a national conflict, the public trust doctrine, things like public grazing. All of these issues factor in. It's an international conflict because Canada impacts how the conflict is perceived and what that larger system looks like. Croatia just stopped hunting in of wolves in that state, and that has had repercussions, and those repercussions impact what happens in Washington. So there are multiple scales going on in this conflict. What are the challenges? Every approach, every action has challenges. So I want to talk a little bit about that. One of the challenges is that war has more clarity around it, right? It's a black-white issue. You're either you're on my side or you're against me, right? And so that clarity, people like that. It gives them a sense of certainty. War is familiar. It is the language of war, the tools and strategies of war are very familiar in our society. War is also rewarded. If you say you're going into battle, war appears strong, it appears powerful. You back that war with money, with resources, political clout, whatever that might be. Peace, on the other hand, and peace building is more subtle. It's not nearly as sexy as war. It's also unfamiliar. We have so many examples of war, and we have created in society institutions and strategies that support war and less that support peace. So it's unfamiliar, it's subtle, and so it can appear weak, right? And certainly a lot of efforts toward that look like you're moving to some mushy middle when you get to a solution, and nobody's happy in the end, right? And that often defines that. And so people say, well, I don't want that kind of collaboration. If that's what peace means and I have to give up so much of what is important to me, then I don't want it. I'm going to go for that all or nothing, and I'm going to stay in the war. Another challenge is that when you have a cycle of destructive conflict in a system, that cycle didn't start last week, it didn't start last month, it didn't start when wolves got on the landscape, and you know, you can just keep going. It started generations ago, it started decades ago, and so then we look at the past. As human beings, we look at the past as an indication of the future. So if your past has been war, right, go back to the timber wars, spotted owls, you just pick your issue, that how that conflict played out gives you a sense of what you think the future is going to look like. And it's hard to imagine a future desired state that could look different than what you've experienced in the past. The other thing is the thinking and approaches and systems and processes that got you into this state of destructive conflict are not the same ones that need to get you out. It has to look different. Change is hard, right? Governments, communities, stakeholders, they have to change their strategies, processes, et cetera, and change is really difficult for people. Another thing is that pursuing peace during war takes a lot of courage. Especially doing it is to step out and really become a champion for peace when a system says stay in war. It takes a lot of courage, it takes risk, and so that adds to the challenge. Social and news media. So 20 years ago when wolves got on the landscape and in a big way in the lower 48. You didn't have the level of social media and news media. That's even changed enormously just in the last few years in the sophistication of how social media is being used. And that certainly plays out, and it further polarized that conflict. I think media can be an incredibly positive agent for change. It's just where things are at now, you have that polarization. The scale of this conflict as well, right? You have a state with 7 million people, but you have literally tens or if not hundreds of millions of people who actually care about this issue. So the scale of this is enormous. I want to share with you some of the analysis of conflict. So earlier this year, as Donnie said, I did a conflict assessment. I met with 90 stakeholders across the state. That analysis, that assessment is dynamic and is ongoing because you are in a dynamic ongoing system. So that circle is now expanded to in the neighborhood of 400. And so that's one piece of this. But I want to just share a little bit with you about the analysis and so you can get a deeper dive into what conservation conflict transformation is. One of the ways that we do that is sharing a model that kind of gives you a sense of the depth of the conflict, and it's called levels of conflict. So if you can imagine, you have three levels of conflict, and these can exist in any kind of conflict. This isn't limited to fish and wildlife. You can have this in your neighborhood, your marriage, in society, etc. So there's dispute, underlying an identity, or deep-rooted conflict. So I'm going to illustrate with an example for you. Imagine, to illustrate dispute, imagine there's a car accident, just a fender bender. Nobody's hurt. Two people get out of the car and they're complete strangers. What do they need to do? Exchange car insurance information, figure out who's at fault, and pay the damage. That's it. That's a dispute. Now, to illustrate underlying conflict, imagine that same exact fender bender. But this time, the two people who get out of the car are an ex-wife and an ex-husband that just went through a very nasty divorce. Is the dynamic different? Yes, right? Because of the history of unresolved disputes. And so what happens is, whatever your current dispute or current issue is, that history, that acrimonious history that came into this current issue is now loaded with a whole bunch of weight and meaning and negative emotion that makes that current issue more explosive. And when you have that underlying conflict, it's often an opportunity. You use those current disputes as an opportunity to right past wrongs. So to illustrate deep-rooted or identity-based conflict, I'm going to take that same car accident, I'm going to put it in a different context. I'm going to put it in the context of the Bosnian War. So during the Bosnian War, you had Serbs, Croats, and Bosniaks. And during the war, each group had to have their license plate would identify whether they were Serb, Croat, or Bosniak. Now, I want you to imagine this fender bender took place the day after peace was declared. Okay, it's going to be a similar case to the dispute level where the two people who get out of the car are complete strangers. But the difference is they look at each other's license plate and they see that one's a Serb and one's a Croat. Is that dynamic different? Yeah. Because they're not seeing each other as an individual, they're seeing each other as a member of that group. Right? And so with identity-based conflict, we talk about the isms of the world, right? It's racism, ageism, sexism, anti-Semitism. And we see this all the time in fish and wildlife conflicts, right? Anti-government sentiment, west side, east side, what is your telephone number exchange, your area code? Are you wearing a cowboy hat? Are you wearing a North Face jacket? Right? All of these symbols, all of these things, we come in with these prejudicial assumptions about who this person is, whether we can trust them, whether we can work together, we assume their values, all kinds of things. So what's also important about this model is that the mechanisms, the processes that you use to address conflict at these different levels are radically different. So disputes, it's a rights-based issue. And so you use a settlement process, right? And so this would be like, you're going to go to court to figure out who actually was at fault in that car accident. With underlying conflict, you use a resolution process. If you're familiar with interest-based negotiation, alternative dispute resolution, and other approaches to addressing conflict, those kind of hover between dispute and underlying. If you have identity-based conflict in your system, you need a reconciliation process. It is a much more complex, profound process. But what's amazing about it is if you can reconcile these deep-rooted relationships, you have enormous, there's this opportunity for enormous creativity in problem solving. And you see these amazing transformations take place. So this, the areas in red, right, the underlying and identity-based conflict, I want to unpack that a little bit more for you and talk a little bit about human needs. So when we think of human needs and think about it, you can think about it with a wolf conflict, you can think about it with any conflict, we have essentially six categories of needs. We often think about needs in terms of economic and physical needs, right? Physiological security needs, right? If anybody remembers Maslow's hierarchy of needs, if you're familiar with that model has been repeatedly refuted by scholars and practitioners in behavioral economics, psychology, sociology, peace building, because it doesn't work. And there's a reason why, and we're going to talk about that in a minute. But I just want to categorize these needs. Identity is how you see yourself in relation to the rest of the world. And when you have identity-level conflict, people fight. You are fighting for your very survival, your very way of life. And what happens in that identity conflict, that us versus them, is that you begin to see the other as being the threat to your existence. A couple other things about identity conflict is when that identity conflict is there, two things happen to groups. One is you have fracturing, right? There's so much fracturing in there. They can't self-organize. They can't work together effectively. The other thing that you see is an inclination toward conformity and authoritarianism. So diverse ideas are not welcomed. They're not heard. You can't have constructive engagement. And it's a little bit like a general going into war. You have an authoritarian leader. Everybody feels that they're under war, right? You're under threat. When you're under threat and you're going into war and the general says, don't retreat, even if you know it's to the death of you, you're not going to retreat because the alternative is treason. If you question a decision, you question or you try to engage in a different kind of dialogue, or you say, hey, maybe this idea isn't the best idea, you get shot for treason. And this happens in non-war settings. It happens in fish and wildlife conflicts. So another category of needs is recognition, respect, acknowledgement, appreciation, saving face. Security, again, we talked about commonly we think of economic and physical security, but there's emotional, social, cultural, and spiritual security. You look at all the wars in the world that have been fought under the name of religion, right? So there's a lot of other things that drive conflict. Connectedness is belonging, love, feeling accepted. Meaning and personal fulfillment, meaning in terms of place, context, personal fulfillment, your ability to reach your potential. And if you see someone else is limiting that ability to reach your potential, again, it's another opportunity for destructive conflict or constructive conflict. And freedom is having voice and control and meaningful participation in decisions that affect you. So what's important about this is that what people talk about when they talk about what's going on in a conflict may not really actually be all that's going on. And a deeper dive into what is really driving the conflict for them, and you find that all of these needs are often, or many of them, are at issue for many people. And people will go after any and all of these needs simultaneously and relentlessly. They don't pick one and then stepwise. They'll just go after all of them because they are critical. You find this all across the globe. These are common to the human condition, and these are needs that every human has. Another point about conflict is that there's three dimensions of conflict. We often think of the substantive side of it, the substance, the thing, that material, tangible thing that people are talking about, right? This kind of corresponds to your dispute in the levels of conflict model. But people are also in conflict over the process, how decisions are made, and relationships, who's making the decisions, and what is the nature of our relationship. The thing is, you can come up with a brilliant solution, but if the process and the relationship piece are not also well supported and engaged in positive, constructive ways, that solution will fall apart. So the key thing is to address all three areas, the substance, the process, and the relationships. I'm going to talk for a little bit about systems conflict, right? So this is sort of a snapshot at an individual or a group level or a static analysis. And now I want to sort of move this up and look at more of a dynamic systems analysis. And to do that, I'm going to tell you a children's story. So there's a story about seven blind mice who are, they need to get across to this field of corn because they are really hungry. And there's this thing in the way and they can't figure out what this thing is. So on day one, and I don't know why they decide to do this on a day-by-day basis, but apparently they do. On day one, the first blind mouse goes out and runs up to this thing and goes up the tail and reports back to the other mice and says, I know what that obstacle is. It's a rope. And the next day, the second mouse goes out and says, I want to go check out this rope. So the second mouse goes up and runs up the leg. And this mouse is like, this is not a rope, reports back. That was a tree. And the third mouse goes out on the third day, explores the trunk, says, I don't know what you people are talking about. It's a snake. Fourth mouse goes up the tusk. It's a spear. You people are crazy, right? Fifth mouse goes out, checks out the ear. It says, it's a sail on a ship. Sixth mouse goes out and explores the back of the elephant and says, oh my God, it's a mountain. The seventh mouse goes out on the seventh day and she decides to run all over the entire thing. And she comes back and she's like, it's an elephant. So why is that important? We often, and it is human nature to want to specialize, to want to narrow down our focus and simplify, right? We want to make sense of things. It is really hard for us to think about cause and effect in long-term, non-linear, dynamic ways. So we want to make things small, we want to make it concrete, we want to make it simple. And so what we do is we understand a part of the system. But imagine there's these mice, elephant, the corn, they need to get over there. If you don't understand the full complex system, you can't figure out how do you remove obstacles, how do you inspire movement in a system, or how do you use what's in that system as an opportunity for positive change. And you can only do that by understanding the whole, not just the sum of the parts. So another, this is a very simplified way of thinking about complex, adaptive, self-organizing systems. Essentially, this is kind of like society. So I want you to imagine that, as this is going to be pretty easy to imagine, there's all these different agents in society, right, in the system, right? There's individuals, institutions, groups, etc. And they all interact with one another in certain ways. Over time, that starts to create a pattern in the social system. Right? So agents interacting creates a pattern. Now that pattern defines the social norms. It defines what is acceptable about behaviors of interactions. And so that pattern, once that is created, it constrains the next cycle of agent interactions. Now, as human beings, thinking about those human needs, right, you want to stay within the social norms of your society. So if you start out here, right, and these are the defined parameters of that pattern, and now you're going to the next cycle of interactions, you don't want to violate those bounds, so you come in a little bit, right? Now you have your next cycle, and that further constrains those behaviors, interactions, actions, what is acceptable in society, and now you've constrained it even further. You keep going, you constrain, 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 and pretty soon you find a lot of polarization and a lack of ability to expand your interaction space. You only have to look in our country over the last few decades to see that further constraining of what is acceptable behavior, acceptable engagement, and problem solving between Republicans and Democrats in our country. And so we have further polarization because that pattern deepens and repeats and deepens again as we go through time if we don't have an intervention. So I want to introduce you to a bit about is some game theory here to think about again. Engagement in complex systems. So you have finite games and infinite games. Finite games, the easiest way to think about this is a sporting event, right? You have fixed boundaries. You know that field of play. If the ball is out of bounds, you know it, and there's rules around that, right? There's also rules of the game, right? Your Seahawks, they know what they're doing, right? And when they're playing the Eagles, they know the rules of the game. And the observers, the audience, also know the rules of the game. The players are fixed, right? You don't have someone coming down from the audience and suddenly putting on a Seahawk jersey, and then the Seahawk jersey person goes on and puts an Eagles jersey, and everything's kind of moving around. That's crazy, right? You have fixed rules, fixed players, fixed boundaries. And what that gets you is predictability, control, and you have a set of expectations. The goal in a finite game is to win. Okay? Now let's move over to infinite games. Infinite games have no boundaries. Remember we talked about the multiple scales of conflict in the Wolf conflict? Local, state, regional, national, international. You ask any individual in this conflict, what are the boundaries of this conflict? And they will define it differently. And it's often used as saying, who has skin in the game? And everybody has a different perspective of who has more or less skin in the game. There's no boundaries. The rules change, the players change, right? So what was acceptable one day suddenly is not acceptable, and in another moment it's not acceptable, or in this community, et cetera. So those rules are changing and the players are changing. Somebody who is not involved in this conflict today may start to engage in that conflict tomorrow. And the other thing is, who's your opponent today may be your ally tomorrow. And so it adds an element of unpredictability. The thing about an infinite game, the goal is not to win. The goal is to keep playing, right? To continual constructive engagement. If you think about fish and wildlife issues, this isn't something that you win in a day. This isn't something that if you win, you have that win-loss scenario. You have to go through time. Think about governments, right? Governments are going through time, we hope, right? So... And the other thing about infinite and finite games is the fact that you can play both, but the important thing is having the capacities to play the infinite game and the finite game when you need to and how, and knowing when to make that right choice and having the capacities to do that. I want to talk to you a little bit about power dynamics in war or destructive conflict. Depending on what role, what level of power you have, people use different strategies and different tools to engage in that war or to win that war. So those reactions vary. Those in the more powerful position use more what are considered more socially acceptable tools such as law, education, political action, money, etc. Right? This is sort of how we operate in society. But when you have a destructive dynamic, you have people who feel marginalized, who have a lack of power. And so the weapons of the weak, the weapons that they use are things like foot dragging, dishonesty, false compliance, desertion, poaching, slander, sabotage, and anonymous threats. And these things, the folks who are in that powerful position are looking at some of these behaviors that are unethical or illegal or pick your label on that. And they say, well, that's terrible. We need to use more law enforcement, more action on our end in order to correct that behavior. There's nothing wrong with law enforcement. Law enforcement is great. Laws are great, all that stuff. But what happens is you have this cycle of conflict. And you have it becomes a contest of who has a bigger hammer, right? Is this sort of a formal power or informal power? And what that does, again, is it creates this cycle and repeats it. So if you use no other intervention but these two kinds of hammers, these two methods, then you just repeat that engagement. So understanding what's really at the root of this and what is at the root of it is a lack of power, an imbalance in the power, and a lack of security in those human needs we talked about before. So your actions are you want to balance that power and secure those needs. Because secure, resilient communities are no longer weak, so they no longer have to use the weapons of the weak. Briefly, what's happening in Washington, and I'm going to leave most of this for questions for you, but just to say that this is my organization's engagement is not just the Wolf Advisory Group. Again, that's at a statewide level. And so my engagement is a local level, at a regional level, and national level as well. It's also to ensure that the work that the Wolf Advisory Group does, that the department is sitting at the table with them, so as advice comes up, they're in full alignment, as well as having WAG engage in their systems with their constituents and stakeholders so that you have more systemic engagement. WAG isn't an island. So engaging systems, engaging multiple scales of conflict. Our engagement is also intragroup and intergroup conflict. So when you have conflict in a system, we think about it in terms of that external conflict, animal rights versus hunters, community versus government, conservation versus or wildlife advocates versus livestock producers, et cetera. But part of the DNA of systems that are in conflict is that you have as much, if not more, internal conflict, same-side conflict. So right now there is same-side conflict within government agencies, within livestock production community, the wildlife advocate community, and the hunting community. And that same-side conflict is a source of fuel for the external conflict. And again, you start to see these cycles. We're doing both intergroup and intergroup engagement. It's also creating space and multiple processes for creative problem solving and reconciling relationships. It's capacity building within these same side groups and institutionalizing change. So one of the pillars of what our organization does is we don't come in and parachute and, you know, sort of fix things for a day and leave. Our goal is to embed that capacity so that this system can continually engage, because again, you're playing an infinite game here. So you need that long-term capacity, and that change and capacities are institutionalized. I'm going to end by leaving you with a proverb. If you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Francine. Donnie, did you want to?
I just want to give you just a quick update now on where we're at in WAG and what we're starting to see as Francine talked about the path that we're on here. So a moment ago, I told you about the WAG process from 2012 to 2014, and a destructive process, one where things were deteriorating to the point where when we tried to have a WAG meeting, it would end after an hour into the day's meeting. We weren't able to get through items such as checklists and those kinds of things. The environment today is very different. As Francine alluded to, we went from a 9-member to an 18-member WAG. We spent the last several meetings working on some of the stuff that she talked about. And I think the biggest change I'd like to share with you is just WAG's ability to work together. I've seen a night and day difference from where we were a year ago to where we are now. We've spent some time working on that safe place, developing those relationships, and that's the biggest part I'd report, is that we're able now to, we're seeing WAG interact with each other where they have a deep enough relationship where they can have tough discussions and stay in the room and look for the progress in those items that we're hoping to. They have some big challenges in front of them. None of it's easy. But I do think that we're on the right path. We're seeing those discussions occur that never did before. A good report.
Thank you, Donnie. Before we open it up for questions, I wanted to introduce Representative Dungy, who's here and wanted to say a few words. Our privilege to have you, sir.
Do I have to use a microphone?
Yes.
Okay.
For the record. Speak clearly into the mic.
Are you going
to
tell me?
We don't limit you to 3 minutes.
You
get 1.2.
She went long, really long.
Yeah. Hi.
It's all yours, sir.
So, thank you. So, I came, Hans Dungy, State Representative, 44th District, Snohomish. There, okay. I came to support this process. Shelley Short was at the last commission, if you remember, this was just a really long drive for her. She would be here. She'll actually be at the, I talked to her a couple of days ago, she'll be at the WAG meeting at Spokane. Yeah, I would recommend that you go to one of those. I've been to two of them. It's kind of genetically hard for me not to speak at an event that goes that long, in which I have an opinion on everything. But I was able to do it. I did have to go to the doctor afterwards about a muscle I pulled. But I'm supportive of it. Sort of the car accident analogy. So if Kretz and I were in a car accident, he would have tried to shoot me afterwards, and I would have tried to beat him up with my bicycle pump. This is sort of pre the world you're seeing now. And Nate really must have loved his visits to my office, in which I would beat him with my chair, things like that. Just sort of go back a little. So that was sort of the pre-world. Kretz and I probably haven't voted the same on, I don't know, for 100 years, right? Last session started, and both of us were looking at another, so essentially a kill session. We'd kill each other's bills. We'd demagogue. We'd do all that. And it just, you know, it didn't seem to work. It wasn't working. And I don't know, this is sort of a which came first, sort of our exhaustion and our realization that we could just kill everybody's bill. And then the idea of, what is it? I can never get this right. It's a human-wildlife conflict transformation, right? Is that it?
No. You, whatever she is.
And we started talking about what we could do, and by the end of the session, we actually passed a bill out of the House, 98 zip, that had the word wolf in it, which is never happened before. And sort of the coalition of Short, Chris Linton, Blake, Vincent By, Kretz, Ranker, Pearson, I mean, these are names who play in this arena, right? All supportive. We had a ungulate study funded and some more non-lethal funding, and then the funding for human wildlife transformation, whatever it is.
Human wildlife conflict collaboration.
Okay. All sort of in a package. We didn't get the bill out of the Senate for complex reasons, but 98 out of the House, and then that coalition held together through the budget to fund this, because we really do think it's important. And I'd like to compliment the department. Nate may twitch just at me mentioning him, but so Donnie, Jim, Nate have really, this is really going in the right direction. And it's the right path. Short and I and Kretz have been following it. And interestingly, that relationship has now grown, because I went over and toured the area with Kretz, drove around, talked to people. The idea, by the way, of providing hay for farmers who are above the irrigation systems, right, who've got their cattle up high. You know, we provided a grundle of money, about $16 million for drought, right? Well, that was all thought to be, irrigation, let's buy water. Well, hay is nothing but solidified water, right? And so you got a lot of people who are above the pipes, but it's essential. So Kretz and I and Short and the governor's office and some others put together, coming out of WAG, this idea of getting hay to those farmers. So that's actually in progress right now. And Kretz and I have been talking about wildfire and what to do about that, because, you know, bluntly, wolves are, but wildfire is actually destroying more farms over there than wolves by a long shot. So we've started talking about that and what we can do about that. One idea, this isn't on the subject much, but establishing a prescriptive burn school in Wenatchee, because prescriptive burn is easier, it's cheaper, but there's no knowledge out there. It's sort of a disappeared knowledge. So to establish a community college project that would certify people in that, and we're working on that. And Kretz and I had good conversations. You know, I don't remember the time frame, but there used to be 40,000 cattle in the Okanagan, and now there are about 12,000. And that isn't wolf-related, you know. Wolf piles on it, and that's where people can fight, so they fight. We talked about, we've also talked about, they call them the 20s. Do you know this term? So 20 is the minimum zoning over there for a parcel. So you get these 100 and 200 and 800 acre ranches where they're chopped up into 20s. You can't put cattle on that, and you got a house. So Kretz has an aversion to buying conservation easements, for putting conservation easements on land. But we talked about, okay, so maybe, and he and I are going to work on this, rewriting the easements so that they meet the needs of protecting the farm, but maybe don't take away things like mineral rights, you know, that a person might be able to utilize. So all those things might come out of this and be able to really help rural economies and reduce the angst and you know, make it successful. So, short of it, support this process. Wanted to come up and do it, and I hope you support it too.
Thank you, Representative. And this is a very positive Saturday morning so far. So we love those.
Do you have any questions for me?
Yeah, I'm going to just open it up to the commission for both of you while you're sitting there.
Okay, I hope we don't disagree too much.
Well, I heard from Representative Kretz that the relationship that he's and Shelley have been building with you is is terrific. It's just very treasured by him. And this is the creativity that you were talking about that flows when people start relaxing their mindsets about identity politics. So, wow, that is so refreshing.
It took some whiskey, too, but that's
no, really terrific. Yeah, no,
good
thank
stuff,
you.
Yeah. I'll let you get technical questions to her if you want.
No, just
okay.
Put your feet up, relax.
I did want to ask, Francine, have you given that presentation to the WAG about this underlying concept of conflict transformation?
So as I said, part of what my organization's engagement in this is capacity building. So the first WAG meeting we had was focused on some capacity building and relationship building. And as with every WAG meeting, we have some element of it that has capacity building. So they're engaging in that. So it's looking at levels of conflict, looking at what are the multiple threats to each community. Tomorrow, we're going to start looking at some of the how do you engage in these complex processes, because they need to make decisions about how they're going to make decisions on recommendations together, how they're going to engage with their constituents and stakeholders. And so having a sense of this, the process, the lessons learned and best practices in this. So, yes, absolutely.
Yes, Mr. Keough. Thank you,
Chair. Thanks for the presentation. I'm kind of thinking about my own life and deals with employers, I've talked with Commissioner Holtzmiller, and he told me that you had interviewed him, and I think are in the process of interviewing others. Maybe could you just give the commission an update of where you are? I mean, how many people you've interviewed, and who you'd like to interview and get their feedback on? Where are you in the process, I guess?
Okay, so there was the initial assessment, and that was 90 stakeholders across all the different, you know, walks of life, including him and Kretz and Short and all the rest of it. And then that happened, and when the department initially asked if we would engage, I said we would come in just to do a conflict assessment, and then it's up to the stakeholders whether we come in, including the department in that, but that this needed to be, you know, a lot of conflict, a lot of disagreement. They needed to at least feel secure and trusting of the third-party neutral organization that was coming in. So that process took a little while because they had to go out and get their feedback, and there was overwhelming support on all sides.
Not universal like the bill that went out of the House. I think you didn't have a perfect score, if I remember.
Yes, and he's since come back and said he was wrong. Anyway, it was 99%, okay? Don't you have somewhere to be?
So, Rodney Dangerfield there. Yeah.
So the department went out and they came back and I was like, in my 34-year career, we've never had this much consensus and cohesion over a decision. So we've had three WAG meetings, and then one other event. Details. The fourth one will be tomorrow. What that engagement looks like. It's gone from about 90 to about 400. And so some of my engagement is with sort of explicit decision-making bodies, processes, et cetera. Some of that is less explicit. It's implicit, right? In any system, you have a whole bunch of different processes going on, so I'm trying to engage with different constituents and stakeholders and leaders and all those different areas. Just to give you a sense of what this looks like, I'm here. I don't live in Washington State, but I'm here probably 7 to 10 days out in the month. This trip, it was I had meetings with the department for a couple days. Then I had meetings with the environmental side and West Side stakeholders for a couple days. Then this commission meeting. Then we have 2 days of WAG meetings, and then I'll be down meeting with folks in the Northeast. in the Blues and in Yakima. So meeting with all stakeholders, again, part of this engaging the system in what's going on. Does that kind of answer your question?
Thank you. Mr. Holtzmiller.
First, I'd like to thank Representative Dungy for coming and speaking to us. I jokingly refer to Joel as my brother from a different mother because our life paths.
I used to call him a brother of another. Yeah.
Our life paths, career, we both were in the logging industry. Uh-huh. Now we're both in ranching. And I would like to think I'm looking for solutions after talking with Joel. I know he is.
Yeah.
And have had some very long, candid conversations with Joel, and he's bought into this 100%. And it was funny to hear his side of the story. And it was close, somewhat. But no, I just wanted to thank
you. So he was saying I was just killing his bills, but he was doing fine on killing my bills, too.
He had a point, though. No, I'm very optimistic on this process, and I'm glad to see both sides when you take, just as you said, basically polar opposites, and now where everybody's pulling in the same direction.
Yeah, well, at some point you realize that war doesn't work, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's great for getting votes at home, but it really doesn't solve their problems, right?
Well, yeah. But when you dug yourself into a hole, the last thing you want to do is get a bigger shovel.
Right, absolutely, yeah.
Mr. Keeney.
Thank you. I think we talked a little bit about this last night, but there are still, I think, folks that would rather fight than work together. And there's groups, there's cattlemen groups that, you know, pulled out of the WAG because they felt that wasn't the direction to go. I think there's some environmental groups that are not a part of the WAG that who knows what they'll do in the future, but how do you see that playing out? Because you have, a really good core group in the WAG that is really making bridges and figuring out ways to cooperate and working towards a focus of kind of the future of wolves and livestock in our state. But you have these outliers. And do you ignore them? Do you bring them along? Do you lead by example that there's so many people cooperating that they become marginalized? Or I'm just curious what the...
No, it's a great question. We have a couple hours, right? A couple more. You're not taking a ferry. No, you do not leave people out. You engage folks. People engage at different levels. They have different levels of readiness and different social, cultural conditions that they're under that allow for more immediate engagement or not. And part of this also is, we can often sort of focus on that, where the problem is or where we perceive, I got air quotes going here, where we perceive the problem. But it's also looking for where those connectors are, where are those change agents, where are those people who want to try something. And so it's not a matter of, you don't want anyone to lose face and the door's open and every side knows, because I talk to them, they know that if they want to design a process at a different level, local engagement, et cetera. But sometimes individuals can want that, but as a community, they're not ready. And so it's respecting that and just continuing that engagement, and then also finding other ways to inspire engagement and positive dialogue or constructive dialogue within that system. And so there's sort of different avenues and different strategies. And so this gets back to your point, sir, is that engagement and my engagement in that dynamic system is looking for those opportunities. It is continuing to assess conditions and find out where opportunities are. I will say that when we go in and we do a conflict intervention in a system, we typically never start with a multi-stakeholder group. We always start with with individuals, which we did, and then same side groups, because as I mentioned about that internal conflict that exists, you want to kind of address that so you're not when you build, you know, you're not adding fuel to the fire, and then you engage the multi-stakeholder process. But as Donnie had said, that the WEG process had gotten to a point that it really needed, and it was an institution that already existed, so it had to be addressed. You couldn't just ignore it. But we wouldn't normally start with a multi-stakeholder process. But again, so WAG is at a statewide level. The folks who pulled out their boundary, right? How they view this conflict and who has skin in the game, they view that a statewide engagement is not representative. That is not a legitimate process for who has skin in the game, right? So when they look at that process, it's not legitimate. So that process was starting to make progress on something that was of benefit to a member of their community, and that's why you saw that pullback. And, you know, I could have told you it was going to happen. They knew it was going to happen, right? Everybody knew it was going to happen, but they were going to try and take that risk, but it was moving, it kind of moved. But there's opportunities, right? I mean, you're always looking for crises that can be an opportunity, or bright spots, right? Things that are working well that you can build on. And so there's a 100 roads here. One of the things I love about what I do is there's no one predictable path. There is no one process. There isn't one process, right? There's multiple processes going on now, and some of them, you know, in my role, I have a role of confidentiality. I work for all the stakeholders in this. I don't work for the department. I work for the department, and I work for all the stakeholders on all the decision-making bodies. I work for the system. So there's a level of confidentiality there. You have these different processes going on, and I lost my train of thought. So does that help?
So in the short, no pun intended, but Short and Kretz are sort of working on one side, and they and I have talked about this, and I'm trying to get those enviro groups sort of into the fold. That's one of the things. And I've watched conversations on the environmental side that are said, you know, come on, be, you know, come into the process, come away from that outlier status. So Joel, and you know, you should talk to Joel about what's going on now that side. And on the enviro side, I think I'm optimistic that we will bring any significant outlier in.
And on that, I would just like to say thank you, Hans, and thanks to Joel and Shelley, because they are really very actively working toward peace. So thank you.
Francine, and thank you, Representative, for being here. Sort of returning to process, I just keep thinking that we're living in a world that's really in chronic war. Our nation's kind of in chronic war. And it's not obviously relevant to the processes you're talking about, except it must come in and at least ping the process. Periodically, the fact that we're sort of stimulated to be at war, it seems like. So how do you try to isolate that or engage it? I mean, it must be part of the dynamic process when issues of Syria and mass migration and all of these things must at times come into this.
So some of it comes in the language of war. You know, I have heard terrorism with regard to the wolf conflict, or again, the wolves are just added on. This existed, and these are longer term conflicts. Terrorism, genocide, Stockholm syndrome. References to ISIS on both sides, right, of the extremes. Absolutely. So that's just the language of it. So it absolutely does. This is a funny thing. So again, our approach comes from the peace building and these other related scientific disciplines. But I was at a peace building conference in the spring, and you know, they're very careful about the language they use, right? That these are all peace building people. And the undersecretary for the State Department was giving a keynote address, and she's talking about countering violent extremism, CVE, which is a, you know, common thing now. And so she's talking about ISIS and stuff, and she's she's up there at the podium, and she's like, yeah, so the wolf at the door is, and I'm like, oh. I'm like, come on. Of course, I'm the only person working in the wildlife sector in the world and in peace building, so nobody really knew me or cared. But I was really, really, stop using that symbolic language, you know. But and that's, you know, really, I mean, I saw a slogan where, and this is sort of some of the symbolism of wolves, why, you know, people are like, why is the wolf conflict? And why is that so powerful? And anyway, I have some theories we could discuss over some time. But I saw it, it was an anti-Muslim slogan, and using a reference from the Bible about the wolf in sheep's clothing and the prophet coming, and tying that to anti-Muslim sentiment. And so wolves, and then, you know, and then you see the angelic, right? On one side you see the angelic, and then the other side you see the devil, right? And so you have that dichotomy, which again kind of continues with that language of words. It's a tough one.
Another one. Since we have the representative here in front of us, I thought I'd ask him his thoughts on how this will all play out as the WAG grows in its strength and resilience in response to crises that might come up. It won't be a crisis, but it will be a point of real intensity if we do take up changes to the wolf recovery plan. And I know there was bills before the legislature that almost passed calling for a few changes, sure, to the wolf recovery plan. I'd just like your insights, your thoughts on changes, sure, to the wolf recovery plan. So, in light of, one more thing is that we are all very worried about how it's going to play out in the portion of Washington where it's still federally listed, and basically our hands are tied. Uh-huh. We will not be able to do any management, and we don't think the federal government is on point yet. But.
Okay, so to that second point, I actually think that the federal government will delist everything. That's my guess. That's just a pure uneducated guess. Just, you know, that Congress made a run at it a while ago, and I am, so as an enviro, I'm actually not that worried about delisting, because if you're managing properly, you're going to do fine on that. But as changes to the wolf plan, so and you should talk to Shelley and Kretz, and I'm with this on this even, as the they sort of took it back to their communities and talked about it, and there was enough paranoia about changing the wolf plan. People thought that opening the wolf plan would make the situation worse. So my advice would be to hold off and wait till sort of the WAG comes to you with thoughts on that. That's really, if you do the two processes at once, they're going to be in conflict. And my advice would be to let the WAG build, and if the WAG brings changes, recommend, you know, then you consider those, right? But not to run two parallel processes. That would be my advice, because you would diminish the value of the WAG, and the small conflicts would come up, and now you would have people sort of trying to game whichever one. So hold off. I think this is the superior process, and that would be my advice at that time.
I think that is the posture that we're in. We're not moving quickly, and we've gotten that signal from Representative Kretz and Short to just go slow.
Yeah.
But the fear is that, you know, as wolves packs spread, those portions of the state that are still federally listed, we're going to have growing conflicts that are truly unmanageable. And
yeah,
maybe you can help in pushing the feds to get ready and respond
effectively. I got a lot of influence in Congress right now.
but so there's just a, so there's a slight cultural difference in the areas that are federally delisted, and I would use cougars as an example of that. If you look at sort of the culture around cougars in the Northeast versus in Kittitas County and such, it's significantly different.
Yeah.
And the Olympic Peninsula, many cougars there, right? And a significant cultural difference. So I wouldn't be that afraid of significant conflicts in that area. There certainly will be, but I think you can do a lot, and I think the culture is slightly different. That's worthy to think about.
Other thoughts, comments?
Thank you much.
Thank you both. Yeah, and
thank you.
Hopefully, we're going to adjourn shortly. Maybe we can just have coffee. You know, chance to have a cup of coffee. And,
okay.
I would love a cup of coffee. It's freezing in here.
I just one last.
You need to weigh more.
You guys are so full of optimism, which I love,
yeah.
And it goes against my nature, especially early in the morning, earlier in the morning. But and knowing of the other Washington that you come from. How the word optimism can even come into a discussion these days. Do you ever feel like there's just somebody you just can't talk to?
That I can't talk to?
Yeah, like,
no.
Like, really?
No, I don't.
Even a junior senator from, say, Texas?
I'm good. It was funny, we met last night, Donnie and Nate and I. Cause Donnie wanted to make sure that, like, you know, he was going to tell me his transition, and I was like, okay, what do you think the commission wants to hear and stuff like that? And they're like, oh, you know, definitely bring up this piece and this piece. Anyway, and they were like, God, you really like people, don't you? And I was like, yeah, I love people. And I was giving this example because he was talking about how great their jobs are right now, like trapping, you know, a wolf and collaring it and all this kind of stuff. And I give this example of working in, so I've worked all over done this work for 20 years all over the world in different, you know, fish and wildlife contexts. And I was doing work in Brazil, and my colleagues who are, you know, wildlife biologists, they're like, oh my God, we have a jaguar that we